Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. A very happy first day of Lent to you. And or some people might want me to say blessed first day of Lent, but you know what blessed means? It means happy. So happy Lent to you today. Yes, that is correct. Fat Tuesday is over. Mardi Gras is over. We now start and I'll put this in quote, 40 days of Lent. Today's Ash Wednesday. So if you're just joining us right now and you didn't know why everybody looks dirty on their forehead today, that's it. It's Ash Wednesday. If you have any questions about the Catholic faith and you are not a Catholic, we're going to hold the phones for you today. 888-318-7884. Perfect day to talk with non-Catholics, where all the Catholics are out there. We're not alone. I mean, other people do this as well, but the Catholics are all out there with crazy looking foreheads today. Why aren't you Catholic is the question we want to ask you. 888-318-7884. Look at him. Joe Heschmeyer with the beautiful dark black ashes. My ashes are almost all gone because I am the most rubbing my forehead, scratching my face person on the earth. So I it's embarrassing to me. I look like I didn't even go to Mass today, Joe.
Yeah, my kids, one of them didn't make it even 10 minutes into Mass after receiving ashes before he'd accidentally wiped them off and then was disappointed. So I understand, but you know,
I rested my head on my hand during Mass. I think at one point I was like, so I'm
you're
like
falling asleep during Mass.
I'm like your 5-year old as far as my ability to keep the ashes. And then you know what? I got to say, Catholics are very helpful. They yell at you about it. Oh, you ruined your ashes already. I don't know how you're yelling at me is helping. It's just a thing. It happened. But all right, let me ask you something before we get started.
Let me just say one thing real quick. Okay. Like I said, ashes to ashes, because we don't really have them. They're Lent.
Oh my gosh! You stopped the show for that?
I needed to share it. I didn't want to do a.
You wanted to make Lent pun?
I thought if Bender is going to make a clip, he's going to think that's too dumb to include, and I feel very strongly that I need to tell the radio.
He's definitely going to say that's too dumb to include. I think, as a matter of fact, he fell asleep while you were saying it. He's sleeping right now.
Rub his ashes right off. Yeah.
Let me ask you this then, because here I am. We're sitting in Mass today. It was beautiful. So lots of kids came, families and all that here to the chapel at Catholic Answers. A wonderful priest came and celebrated Mass for us. Then here comes the reading for the gospel, and Jesus is really direct. Stop showing off with your public prayer. Stop showing off with your public fat. Wash your face. Anoint your head. Because, look, the one who's drawing attention to themselves or him or herself is already rewarded. He says several times they already have their reward. He already got his reward. Then we all walk out of the chapel with a giant black mark on our forehead like we're trying to show off to everybody. How can we Catholics get away with this?
Yeah, it's great because on the surface, it looks like we are being flagrantly hypocritical. Like not just violating what the gospel tells us to do, but actually having that be the gospel reading of that day. But surely the church isn't just like, we don't care what the Bible says, here's the reading.
Please don't call me Shirley. Yeah,
obviously something else is going on. And the important thing is, Jesus says in Matthew 6, verse 1, beware of practicing your piety before men in order to be seen by them.
Oh, yeah.
It does not mean that practicing your piety before men is automatically wrong. The question is, what are your motives for doing so? Because the motives of the hypocrites was that they wanted to impress the people around them. And Ash Wednesday is not about impressing other people with, you know, how holy you are or anything like this. Quite the contrary. The point of Ash Wednesday is a public acknowledgement that I'm a sinner. And so it really is the opposite of what the hypocrites, what the Pharisees were doing. they were talking about how holy, how self-righteous they were. We are doing the opposite. Now, I think it's important to recognize Matthew 6, which talks about not performing your piety before men in order to be seen by them, comes half a chapter after Matthew 5, verse 16, which says, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who's in heaven. So within this very short span of time, we're told, basically, there are times and places where it's good to do good works so that you can be seen by others, where you want to do the right thing and you want to inspire other people. You know, if you've ever raised kids, you know there are times where you're very intentional about, you know, getting on your knees and praying by your bed so that your kids can see you pray. Like, you want to both do the right thing and you want to set a good example by doing the right thing. That's not what Jesus is condemning in Matthew 6. What Jesus is condemning in Matthew 6 is doing the right thing to try to impress other people so they'll be pleased with you, rather than to set a good example by your good works so that they'll give glory to your Father who's in heaven. So in both Matthew 5 and in Matthew 6, Jesus talks about times where we might think, oh, maybe we should do this pious work publicly. And he tells us to do it when it's going to lead people to give glory to our Father in heaven, and not to do it if we're just trying to get their accolades so that we can be seen by them and our reward is just the acclaim of others. So by all means, you should embrace Ash Wednesday. You should have ashes on your forehead, but you should do it for the right reasons. If you're doing it to show how pious you are, you're missing the point of Ash Wednesday. If you're doing it as a call to conversion, to lead people into right relationship with our Father in heaven, then it's good and you should do it.
I got to be honest with you, Joe. I feel like I'm mixed. Like, do you see what I'm saying?
In terms of what you're doing?
Yeah. Like, when I think about my motives, I'm like, yeah, my motives are always a little bit mixed. You know, I do want to give glory to God. I also kind of like people to think, oh, look at Mr. Holy Pants over there. You know, that's kind of, I'm kind of a,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's actually a great point, because the Catechism even points out that a good work can become a bad work if you're doing it for sinful motives. Like, if you're doing it for purposes of your own pride, then it stops being a thing that you ought to do. And so we want to talk about it in these two senses. One, it is perfectly acceptable for you to have a mix of motives, some of them better than others. That's absolutely normal. You can go to work because we're spreading the gospel, but also because it's a lot of fun, but also because you want to feed your family. All of those things can be true at once.
Right.
Not every motive has to be the highest, purest motive. That's not a requirement, and that would be a heavy burden we wouldn't want to impose on anyone. However, while you can have higher and lower motives, you should never be led by sinful motives. And so if you cross that line into a sinful desire to win the acclaim of others, like the hypocrites have, where you want to seem holier than you really are, and you want to give a false impression of yourself, that's when it becomes a problem. Wonderful. But the mere fact, even the fact that you want to be held in good esteem by others, is not by itself bad, unless you're willing to be a hypocrite to get there. You're willing to, you know, be self-righteous or present one image publicly while you're a very different person internally. Yeah. Those kind of things. That's when it becomes problematic.
Got it. All right. Why aren't you Catholic? That's our question for the callers today. 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. And I'm going to go right to Mackenzie in Pasco, Washington. I always like it when Mackenzie calls. Welcome back, Mackenzie. Go ahead with your, I shouldn't say go ahead with your question. I have a question for you. Why aren't you Catholic?
There's one thing I would like to point out, given this whole Ash Wednesday thing. There's actually more than one holiday that's going on right now. The night before Ramadan started and the day before the Lunar New Year started, so it's really interesting. To my question, Jesus did say that you cannot serve both God and money. Certain Protestant churches, I'm not saying Protestantism as a whole, I'm just saying certain denominations that have supported the MAGA movement have combined both politics, religion, and money. Certain church or leaders or individuals putting their money towards a political candidate. Whereas with the Latter-day Saint Church, I mean, our 15th leader of the church, Gordon B. Hinckley, said that, you know, we should address issues and not personalities, and it is the personalities of those churches. I mean, we take a hands-off approach when it comes to endorsing people. I mean, our church does not endorse any, you know, specific political party, even though you have a freedom of voting whoever you want to vote for. But ultimately, I believe certain Protestant groups have failed in listening to what Jesus had said about serving both God and money. Would the Catholic Church agree with that?
I think we'd make a few distinctions. I would note, kind of in passing, I mean, Joseph Smith did run for president in 1844. So it isn't as if, like, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has historically been completely nonpartisan. But the distinction between the legitimate secular sphere and the religious sphere is a legitimate one. I don't think that's so much a case of serving God and money, because I think someone can be thoroughly political and religious without being greedy, without, you know, the warning against serving mammon is using money as an idol. And I don't think someone who's political is automatically guilty of that. Certainly they can be. And certainly there can be another danger, which is that you're putting your trust in princes, that you're trying to establish authority through, you know, mere earthly power. And that, to the exclusion of God, is a terrible error and even a temptation. If you think about the temptations that Jesus faces in his first Lent, one of them, the devil says, you know, if you'll worship me, I'll give you all this power and authority on earth. That if we sacrifice our fidelity to Christ and his kingdom for earthly power, then that is a terrible bargain. We've exchanged God for something radically, infinitely inferior to God. And, you know, in some way, shape, or form, that's always the temptation with sin. Trade God for some earthly delight. The flip side to that, though, is that all power, as Romans 12 tells us, all authority comes from God. And, or excuse me, I said Romans 12, Romans 13. In Romans 13, St. Paul says, there's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So that's why he tells us to be subject to the governing authorities. But in a democracy, that means that we should, you know, we have a duty in a democracy to participate in the ways, because we're part of the governing structure of the country. Like it or not, like, the nature of a democracy is that it is ruled by the demos. And so we are called as part of the people to help rule the country. And like all authority, this is ultimately instituted by God. And so we have to use that in a responsible way. I would suggest that if you're using that in a way that is blindly partisan, where you're just down the line, I always agree with party A, I never agree with party B, that's probably not a good sign, because it's very unlikely that any earthly political party is just going to happen to match up with God on everything. And so it would seem in that case that you've allowed yourself to be catechized by a worldly political movement more than by your faith and more than by the church. And so it's fine for Christians to be political. It's fine for Christians to have an opinion about how a just, ordered society ought to look. But the caveats there are, number one, our ultimate orientation towards the world comes from Jesus Christ. It doesn't come from any political party. And number two, our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. We're not putting our trust in princes. You can say this candidate, this issue, whatever, is more in keeping with a Christian worldview. But if you're imagining you could, you know, inaugurate the kingdom of God by voting the right way, then you've fallen for a very dangerous error. And the Catechism actually connects that particular error to the error of the Antichrist, of trying to create a kind of earthly Christ with a millenarianism kind of movement. So we would say, yeah, very much watch out for that, of making politics, like anything else, a god. Does that make sense, Mackenzie?
Yeah, but I would also say that, you know, God created man, but eventually, even to the present day, I believe that the government has gotten to a part to a point that the established laws in place, I mean, they've subverted certain things. I mean, they've gotten to the point where the USCCB has had to put out a statement against to what this administration, as of now, is doing. I mean, when it inevitably goes against God's laws, you know, human laws going against God's laws, I mean, somebody has to say something, and I'm glad that the USCCB did.
Yeah, I mean, we are reminded of St. Peter's words, we must serve God rather than men. Like, we are, on the one hand, as Christians, called to be, as St. Paul says, subject to the governing authorities. But if the governing authorities violate the law of God, our fidelity is to a higher law, the law of God. And so when the government acts in an unjust way, when politicians, when your preferred political party act in an unjust way, you have a moral call to not go along with that, and even, as appropriate, to stand up against it and to speak out against it. So, yeah, I agree. I think the USCCB did the right thing on taking what I'm sure they knew was going to be an unpopular stand on immigration, because they saw, I think correctly, that some of the things being done were not easy to harmonize with a vision of the gospel, or with the way we're told to treat the stranger and the immigrant.
Mackenzie, that I gotta go to the break. We're a little late for the break, but thank you. It's always great when you call. Thanks for being numero uno today. There's one line open. If you're not Catholic and you want to tell us why aren't you Catholic, give us a call. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from Catholic Chemistry, a dating app for Catholics. Founded by a longtime member of the Catholic Answers team, CatholicChemistry.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
What brings you closer to our Lord during Lent?
I want to be more kind, and I want to be always excellent at church with Jesus. And Jesus loves me, and I really want to be closer to Him.
As you journey toward Easter, listen to EWTN Radio for encouragement to help you to draw closer to God's love and mercy.
Visit EWTN.com/Lent.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you're not Catholic, we're holding the lines for you. Heading off to, where are we going now? Omaha, Nebraska. Fred in Omaha, Nebraska. Fred, why aren't you Catholic?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Very well.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. So my concern is actually the phrase on the question. When you ask someone, why aren't you this, it does come off as somewhat off-putting and condescending. And what I would argue maybe a better question would be, who inspired you or what inspired you to pursue your faith, your path of faith, if it's not Catholicism? That's a good question
as well. It's just it's a totally different question.
Yeah, like
well, no, because it's different. It's a different spin to saying, why aren't you this? Because, for example, I work with a lot of Catholics and non-Catholics and different faiths, and for a lot of them, it's very much tied to the culture. They were born into this faith, whether it be Islam, Judaism, Lutheranism, mm-hmm. Presbyterianism, whatever. And obviously, if I were to start the question, why aren't you Catholic? Well, that comes off. I would come off as kind of insulting or condescending if I were to ask them, hey, who inspired you to pursue this faith? You know, let's say I ask a chaplain, hey, chaplain. Who inspired you? What inspired you to become a chaplain in this denomination? And I'm sure they'll tell me their spiritual journey and how God inspired them, how they felt called to serve their country and to serve God and so on and their fellow community. Versus I were to say to them, hey, chaplain, why aren't you Catholic? Well, he or she's going to look at me kind of funny. And it's like, what kind of question is that?
Yeah, so I think that's a totally fair thing to ask. The question is meant to be, I think, a little bit of a challenge to say, you know, so we'll put it like this. If someone is a Protestant, the nature of what it is they're protesting is in relation to Catholicism. So to be a Protestant in a coherent way, you have to have some sense of why you're not Catholic. Whereas Catholicism was never a reaction or a protest against anything else. So a Catholic doesn't need to know Methodism exists in order to be a Catholic. But a Protestant needs to know that Catholicism exists to even understand why they exist as a protest movement. Like, it's right there in the name. So there is, in Protestantism, a rejection or a challenge or a desire to reform Catholicism. This is what it means to be Reformed Christian or Protestant or any of these things. Like, they are acknowledging in the name that they are breaking away from or attempting to reform or fix or somehow responding to this other thing. They're an offshoot. They're a sect. They aren't a thing that exists of themselves. Like, you couldn't talk of Protestantism without Catholicism. And somewhat similarly, even if you say something like atheism, the term atheism would make no sense if people had never heard of the idea of God, because it's a rejection, of course, of theism. And so it's a reaction against. And so someone could believe in God and have no idea that anyone on earth didn't believe in God, could have no idea there was such a thing as atheism. But if somebody declared themselves an atheist, that requires, like, if there was a world in which nobody believed in God, there would be no such thing as atheism. Like, we don't have a term for people who don't believe unicorns exist, because we all just take for granted that we don't believe unicorns exist. But atheism as a movement, as a philosophical system, as a set of beliefs, exists in response to theism. So it makes sense to ask an atheist, like, why are you not a theist? Why are you, you know, because they've defined themselves in a way that is in opposition. So you're right. Like, some people might be offended by the term. I don't think it's offensive to ask people who are one thing why they're not something else. And I don't think it's offensive to invite people to say, hey, I believe Jesus Christ is who he says he is. I believe he really did rise from the dead. I believe he really did found a church. I believe that church really is visible and structured. And I believe he really does want all of us to be part of it. I don't think there's anything in there that's offensive. I would be interested in your response, Fred. Would you find that to be too combative or too offensive of a take?
Generally, yes, because unfortunately in my past, I have encountered people of all different denominations start off with, why aren't you us? If you're not us, you're going to go to, you know, this place. I called back in December. You sent me a wonderful book, How to Talk About Jesus to Others, so thank you. But again, I just think a better phrase, rather than say, why aren't you this, a better question would be, well, what do you believe in and what made you pursue this?
So yeah, I don't oppose that phrasing as well. Like, but those are just two completely different questions. Like, if I say,
possibly,
like, who inspired you as a Methodist, that doesn't really tell me if you have any lingering doubts about Catholicism, or explain to me why you're not currently a Catholic. Like, even if you're like, I think, you know, these Protestant thinkers like C.S. Lewis are amazing. I also think Protestant thinkers like C.S. Lewis are amazing. But that doesn't explain why you're a Protestant and not a Catholic, unless I have some sense of what your reasons are for being Protestant and not Catholic, not just what do you like within Protestantism, because those might be things I like within Protestantism or that any non-Protestant likes within Protestantism. It doesn't really get to the heart of the question we're trying to ask. Like, I understand being delicate, but if we're so delicate we tiptoe around the actual issue of, hey, we're divided, Christ doesn't want us to be divided, what would it take for us not to be divided? Like, at some point, I think we do have to have those hard conversations. And I think that's true even when we're talking to a non-Christian, even if there is that, I'm worried not just that we're not one, but maybe that you're not going to go to heaven. Like, that's not rude. Like, in the same way, I don't think it's rude if a doctor tells a person they have cancer. Now, they might do it in a rude way. They might do it in a more diplomatic way. But if somebody has cancer, we can't, in the spirit of politeness, just be like, well, we can't mention that to them. We should just ask them, like, what do they like about their health? No, like, at a certain point, we have to be able to address the elephants in the room. Fred, I don't know if you're originally from Omaha. I'm a Midwesterner as well. And I know there can be a strong impulse to sort of not have those hard conversations. And that often that means the people having those hard conversations are the people who are the most tone deaf and maybe kind of insensitive to the feelings of others. But I think that's a reason for people who have maybe more of an awareness of other people's feelings to have the hard conversations, but in a gentle and charitable and loving way. Like, I don't think it's either or. I don't think it's either you just yell at somebody or you just avoid the hard issues.
Well, so you asked my perspective why I did not pursue, why I pursued one faith, one Christian faith over Catholicism. It came down to the example and which community was more welcoming than the other. I will say, when I grew up in the Northeast and in my time in the military, the best examples were from Christian chaplains, Christian community of different denominations working together, both in the military and in our guild community. And unfortunately, some of the worst examples and some of the ones who built the most walls to block people out of their community, unfortunately, in my experience,
one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What is the Catholic Church? Everybody seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people try to make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Fred in Omaha, Nebraska. We're asking folks, why aren't you Catholic? Fred was clear he doesn't like the question. And I do think it's a little different to ask the question on a radio program. I just don't walk up to people in airports and go, why aren't you Catholic?
I kind of wish you would.
Yeah, I'm already not very popular in airports. I'm the guy that's confused in front of you, who's probably between you and your flight that's taking off in 20 minutes. So I don't need to be less popular in airports. But Fred's point was, look, that's kind of a rude question. Why aren't you Catholic? But he was gracious enough to answer it before we went to the break. So, Joe, I'd like to get your response. I mean, his assertion was, look, he's in the military, and the best examples of Christianity were non-Catholic chaplains, not Catholics.
Yeah, I think it's an understandable reason, first of all, Fred. I had a question about that, though, because I actually had a couple questions. One, it sounded like you were comparing chaplains to ordinary Catholics, and I sort of think that's hopefully a bit of a stacked deck, meaning hopefully chaplains are being taken from amongst the best examples of Christianity any particular, you know, church or denomination can provide. Like, I would hope the Catholic chaplain is better behaved than the random Catholic enlistee. I mean, I would hope he's well behaved too, but I would hope that the priest isn't worse behaved. So I suppose I did wonder about that comparison, where you seem to be saying you met bad Catholic laymen and good Protestant chaplains, but you seemed like you could kind of do the same thing the other way around, of being like, well, I met some, you know, bad Protestant soldiers and good Catholic chaplains. Maybe you didn't have that experience. But then the second thing, and just hearing about your story about kind of the welcome, it's a good reminder to us as Catholics of taking welcome and hospitality very seriously. But I'm curious, from your perspective, if there's a limit to it. Does truth enter the equation at all for you? Meaning, one of the things that separates the different denominations of Protestantism from the Catholic Church are questions of doctrine, questions on which there's a right or wrong answer. Is your decision to just sort of go with the people you find the most friendly and welcoming, rather than to maybe explore the truth of the questions being disputed?
No, it was them emphasizing the gospel, you know, because I attended multiple services in the course of my career. Now, part of it's also frame of reference. By the time I met these chaplains, I was a little more mature in my faith. When I met those poor examples, that was in my early years when my faith was still forming. And unfortunately, therefore, it was still forming. Unfortunately, those individuals or those community, whatever you call it, were choosing to build walls over bridges. So it's just one of those things, I guess, goes back to frame of reference. When you're younger, you're impressionable. Mm-hmm. It makes a very profound negative impression. You're older, you're mature. You meet, as you say, the best. But yes, they did talk about the gospel many times. And any questions about, you know, the nature of what he's, again, I'm former military, I'm retired military. But again, any question I brought up about ethics or what have not, it came down to, yes, it was based on the gospel. The chaplains all I met with, both Catholic and Protestant, all basically said, yeah, almost all Christians can pretty much believe in grace. And the big difference is, okay, where do you go about with sanctification? And that's where you see the differences in interpretation of gospel and et cetera on the path of sanctification. And I, having spoken to chaplains of different denominations, to include Catholic priests, I can see how the differences are there.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't want to ask why you aren't Catholic, but it sounds like maybe there are implicit within your answer, maybe there are doctrines you think Protestants get right and Catholics get wrong?
Okay, so I'm actually a blending of the two in a strange way.
Okay.
I attend Mass. Mm-hmm. I do belong to a Christian church, but I do attend mm-hmm. Mass. I get a blessing. I don't get Catholic communion.
Okay.
I follow the Jesuit. I was educated and trained in Jesuit charisms. I follow Jesuit charisms heavily, you know, of mm-hmm. Spiritus Personalis, seeking God and everything I see, both good and bad, in the way it affects in life, you know. And I try and find God in all things. I also do practice the magis to push myself physically and mentally for the more. And if I have those in need, yes, I pray for them. But also, and if they are Catholic, I am respectful of their beliefs, and I do pray to specific saints on their behalf, in addition to praying to God.
Interesting.
That is a hybrid.
That is, that's quite the blend. It seems like you sort of line up in a very unique place spiritually. Is that fair to say?
Yes, because unfortunately, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, unfortunately. And mm-hmm. it's just one of those things. I have the benefit of attending Mass regularly. I have the benefit of attending a Christian service. I've had the benefit.
When you say Christian, do you mean Protestant, or are you saying you don't think Catholics yes. are Christian?
Oh, okay. No. It's a Protestant service.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah, but generally speaking, I go back to when I was an advisor in Iraq. I go back to what the Muslims called me. The Muslims in the Iraqi army did not call me a Catholic or a Lutheran or a Presbyterian. They said, you know, you are an honorable Christian.
Well, that's nice. I mean, it's good that they recognized you as honorable.
Yes, and that was the highest compliment I could ever receive at that time when I was deployed.
Yeah, I suppose I would just ask on your journey, what role you see for the visible church, and how you think that question of what the visible church should look like is meant to be resolved by Christian standards?
I'm not sure. That's the hard part, because I am seeing, as a simple, you know, member of the community, there are schisms within different parishes in the Catholic Church over various social justice issues.
Okay.
You go to one parish, their view on, let's just say, LGBTQ, okay, that umbrella, mm-hmm. is different from parish to parish within the Catholic, within you know, the church. I'm like, wow, it's not for me to judge. I'm just observing. Wow, okay. This one priest has one view of hate the sin, but don't condemn the sinner. And I've seen and read about other priests who have a much more hardline approach. And then, unfortunately, I've heard rhetoric from would-be Christian leaders who is very violent, to the point where they want to take LGBTQ and, you know, and be violent toward them because of who they are.
You're saying, like, you've seen that from Catholic priests or just from various people who are...
No, not Catholic priests.
Okay.
So, like, for example, the Westboro Baptist Church, for example.
Oh, yeah. I went to school in Topeka. I'm familiar with them very well.
I'm sure you've exposed to see the vitriol they put out.
I've gotten some nasty emails from them directly, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So. What they have toward fellow Christians, to Catholics, to anyone not them, to LGBTQ, you know, it is just vile what they say, for example. You know, so
no disagreement there. So, okay, well, look, it's interesting. You seem like you're in a unique spot, and it seems like you're someone who tries to find the good in everybody, which is good. I worry that you can, find yourself in a place where you make kind of an ideal out of sitting on the fence and not having a side, so to speak, and that the call of Christianity includes a call for the flock to be one. Like in John 10, Jesus says that he's coming to gather the flock so there can be one flock with one shepherd. And if our solution there is we're each doing our own thing and we might appreciate what somebody else is doing, but we're all kind of on our own journeys pretty independently, my concern is that that's not actual faithfulness to what Jesus is calling us to. Like when he prays that all will be one, as he and the Father are one, I think he wants more from us. Now, I think you're absolutely right. That's not just a call for every Christian to be part of the Catholic Church. I think that also includes a call for us to subordinate our own political preferences and private views to what the church tells us. Because otherwise you can have this situation where you have not full-on schism, but at least you can have factionalization of the kind that St. Paul warns against in 1 Corinthians 1. And so if people are identifying themselves by their group within Catholicism against other Catholics, I think you're right to see that as a real problem. So I don't know if I can move the needle for you at all, Fred, but I would say maybe just work on that question of, like, when Jesus comes, one of the things he's here to do is gather the lost tribes of Israel, gather all of the sheep of the flock into one. Like, this is very clearly one of the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. This is very clearly one of the messianic claims Jesus makes about himself in places like John 10 and in John 17. And then when you look at, like, Gamaliel's challenge in Acts, one of the points he makes is, if this isn't of God, it's going to factionalize. And if it is of God, it'll stay together. And so where do we find a church that is one visible church, even as it often feels like you're herding cats within that church? And I would suggest to seriously read on and pray on that question and see if God isn't inviting you into fuller communion.
And that will bring us to another break. We have, it's been a good long conversation. I'm glad we had it, Fred, but we got to take this break. Right back where we will ask more folks, all of them waiting on the line right now, why aren't you Catholic, on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with a gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Dr. Marcus Peter, and Father Wade Menezes. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
I have to say, these are some of our best shows, and I'm always grateful to the people who are willing to call and tell us why they're not Catholic. It does make for great radio, and we just enjoy the conversations as well. Justin is in Colorado listening on the Catholic Answers app. You've got the app, Justin, and you're not Catholic. Why aren't you Catholic?
The reason I'm not Catholic is because I was not born Catholic.
We can fix that.
I was born in a Protestant evangelical family.
Okay.
And then I committed one of the few mortal sins that anti-Catholics recognize, and that is marrying a Catholic. So I've been
slowly drawn into reading the Church Fathers.
Catholicism. Well, yeah, so it started with realizing that sola scriptura doesn't really work. So I'm slowly working through different issues. And at first, the Pope was not a problem, but it wasn't a hard pill to swallow. But as I've gone down different rabbit holes, one of them I went down was the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith, where I think it's chapter 26, paragraph 4, they're talking about Christ being the one and only head of the church, and that therefore the Pope is the Antichrist. I listened to a couple podcasts from, you know, anti-Catholic Christians, and to be fair, they were very, very poorly cited. They didn't give a lot of references to what they had to say or the claims that they made. So a lot of it I was able to take with a grain of salt. But the one argument they were making that I've had a hard time dissuading, I guess, in my mind, was their statement that in 2 Thessalonians 2, talks about how the man of lawlessness takes his seat in the temple of God and proclaims himself to be God. And so their argument was that, you know, the temple of God is the church. And so the Pope takes his seat in the church. And granted, I think understanding can be had on different terms that the Pope uses and stuff like that. But one of the quotations they gave was from Pope Leo XIII in his encyclical Reunion of Christendom, where he says, that he is, well, I'm trying to remember exactly what the phrasing was, but it was something along the lines of, we sit in the seat of God Almighty. And so that, you know, their argument was that, you know, here we have an example of the Pope claiming that he is God. He's taken his seat in the temple of God in the church. And yeah, I've just been trying to find some better peace on that topic and wondering if you could help me there.
All right.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So there's several things there that I want to kind of unpack, if you don't mind. One of them is, what does the Bible say about the Antichrist? Because, you know, 2 Thessalonians 2 doesn't actually mention the Antichrist. I mean, it might be the same thing, but it mentions the man of lawlessness and the son of perdition. Now, one thing that should be clear is, it would be very strange to call the Pope the man of lawlessness. Like, one of the big raps against Catholicism is we have too many laws and too many rules. And so there's not this spirit of, you can reject the law of God. Like, so in other words, to view the authority of the Pope as being associated with lawlessness seems like we're just ignoring what the Bible actually says, even in 2 Thessalonians 2. Additionally, when the term Antichrist is used, it's only used by John, and it's only used in 1 and 2 John. And he says, 1 John 2:18, children, it is now the last hour. You've heard that Antichrist is coming. So now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. Then in 1 John 2:22, just a few verses later, it says, who is the liar but he who denies that Jesus Christ, that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist, he who denies the Father and the Son. So a good test of, is the Pope the Antichrist? Does he deny the Father and the Son? No, he doesn't. Then 1 John 4, he says, by this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit which confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God, and every spirit which does not confess Jesus is not of God. This is the spirit of Antichrist, of which you heard that it was coming, and now it is in the world already. Well, does the Pope say Jesus is not of God? Well, no, he doesn't. He clearly teaches that Jesus comes from God, which is the Spirit of God at work, not the spirit of the Antichrist. So again, like every time you see the term Antichrist, it doesn't sound remotely like anything the Pope is saying or doing. Then the last part is 2 John chapter 1, verse 7. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, men who will not acknowledge the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the Antichrist. So the last hallmark is somebody who denies the incarnation. Does the Pope deny the incarnation? He doesn't. So it's very clear that if you go with what Scripture says about the Antichrist, rather than what, you know, London Baptists say about the Antichrist, that just doesn't sound remotely similar. So what do we do with this other part? Because you're right, there are these bold claims that the Pope makes where he claims to be able to, you know, speak and act with divine authority. And this, I would suggest, takes looking at what the Bible has to say about authority more seriously. Because Jesus says in Luke, what is it, Luke 17:10? He who hears you hears me. No, is Luke 10:17? What is that? Let me look it up. Sorry. Luke 10:16, excuse me. He who hears you hears me, and he who rejects you rejects me, and he who rejects me rejects him who sent me. That's what Jesus says to those who he's sending out in his name. So you've got Jesus, who isn't the Father, but is sent by the Father, acting with the authority of the Father. He says in Matthew 28 that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him, meaning by the Father. And then he sends out his disciples and says, go therefore and make disciples of all nations. So there are people that Jesus sends into the world with divine authority, not because they're God, but because God sent them out. The Father sent Jesus with the authority of the Father. Jesus then sends his followers with divine authority. And we see them speaking and acting with that divine authority. So you have a few obvious places, Matthew 16 and Matthew 18, where Jesus says, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. This is a promise of divine authority attaching to the apostles. St. Paul says, if we triumph, we will reign with Christ, which is, again, a promise of sharing in the authority of God. You have Acts 15, when the church speaks on behalf of God and says it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. You have numerous places in the New Testament where the inspired authors speak on behalf of God. So I would suggest that clearly is not Antichrist, unless you're going to say the disciples are all Antichrist, or, you know, somebody acting with divine authority because they've been sent by God. That might be true or not, but that's not what the Antichrist is. They're not claiming to be God. They're claiming to be the vicar of Christ, claiming to act on behalf of Christ is not the same as claiming to be him. Does that make sense?
Oh, hang on. I'm so sorry. I put him on hold, and Justin, I apologize. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that does make some sense. Much of their argument was, you know, I know that the London Baptist Confession of Faith kind of throws the whole book at the Pope in that.
Yeah.
In that portion, they call him, you know, I'm sure you know, they throw the whole book at him. It's just one of those things that I have a hard time moving.
It also
out of my mind
turns
getting...
the Antichrist from an individual into an office, which is obviously wrong, you know, because there's not just like one pope. There have been a bunch of popes. So were all of them the Antichrist? That seems like, I mean, it just, it has all the hallmarks of being really bad exegesis, where you're mad at somebody, and then you just, you know, like, I don't know if you've ever, maybe I'm telling on myself too much here. You hear something in Mass, or you read something in Scripture, and you're frustrated with somebody, and you're like, they need to read this. And it's like, you probably need to read that. And so similarly, the London Baptists were mad at the Pope. And so they're taking this stuff about usurping the authority of God while forming their own church, which God alone has the power to do. And they're blaming the Pope. And it's like, guys, the Pope didn't invent the Catholic Church. You're doing something the Pope would never dream of doing. Like, you're forming your own church. That's much more of an arrogation of divine authority than speaking on behalf of God. All Christians are called to speak on behalf of God. This is part of what it is to be a Christian. Like, to be baptized priest, prophet, and king, you are called to share in the proclamation of the gospel. That is speaking on behalf of God. So, yeah, I think some of it is just the Pope speaks in a way that is foreign and off-putting to many Protestant ears. But if you were to actually say, well, is it biblical or not? I'd be hard pressed to see why it wasn't biblical.
Okay.
Yeah. That helps. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely. Justin, please call back on this journey. I'm very excited for you.
And thank you very much for the call. I'm going to go to Pocatello, Idaho, where Cormac is watching on YouTube. Cormac, why aren't you Catholic?
Hey, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, very well.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the reasons is, you know, I called in, I think, last week about ex-Mormonism and whatnot, but I've been looking at both the claims of orthodoxy and Catholicism because of the apostolic succession, and that's not the premise of my question. The premise of my question is a lot of the orthodox apologetics, and especially with the church fathers, I've noticed this a lot, is the early church fathers, it is undeniable that they say, you know, to be in communion with this church, Rome, is to be in the true church, right? Mm-hmm. The emphasis on being in communion with Rome in the early church fathers, pre-schism, pre-even Nicaea, right?
Yep.
So one of the big orthodox counters to that I've seen is, well, Rome used to be orthodox, and after the schism, they weren't orthodox, and so now, of course, the fathers would say, you know, be in communion with Rome, but now they're not orthodox. I think it's a little selective. I don't think it's the greatest point, but it's one that I can't really find a good response.
Well, I think just recognizing the absurdity of it. If the claim is you have to be in union with the Church of Rome unless you disagree with the Church of Rome, that becomes meaningless.
Yeah, exactly. And that was,
because,
that
like, what heretic, you know, throughout the ages who broke off communion with the Church of Rome wouldn't have said the same thing the Orthodox do now. They would just give a different date. If you're Oriental Orthodox, mm-hmm. you think the church went wrong at Chalcedon, or you think the church went wrong, you know, whatever your particular schism, whatever your particular heresy is, you just say, oh, sure, we all should have been part of the Church of Rome until I disagreed with them. And that's kind of showing the absurdity of the position, I think. That either you have a principle or you don't. But to say you have a principle until it gets inconvenient is to not really have a principle. And, you know, none of the early church fathers talking in this way, you know, people like Irenaeus talking about the necessity on account of the preeminent authority of Rome for all Christians to be in union with this church, none of it is saying, I happen to agree with them and I hope everybody else does. That is absolutely not what they're saying. They're saying there is an authority to this church, and it's the Apostolic See, and so it's a matter of necessity to be in union with them. You read Optatus against the Donatists in the early 300s. You read Irenaeus in the 100s. I mean, it's just super clear. They're not just saying we happen to agree. They're referring to the leadership and authority in the orthodoxy of Rome as this thing that we can just accept and you know, build our unity with the church around.
Cormac, do you have a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church?
I do No, I've been wanting to pick it up for a while.
Well, I think you're about to. What you have to give us is an address where we can mail it. If you'll just hang on and give Edgar your address, we'll mail it off to you. Why aren't you Catholic this hour and next hour? Joe Heschmeyer will stay with us. And we'll take whatever anybody who calls and is willing to tell us why they're not Catholic, we'll take that call. 888-318-7884. I'm sorry I've kept some of you waiting, but we'll get right to you when we get back on Catholic Answers Live.